Today's video is brought to you by Audible. Audible provides an easily accessible way to access audiobooks for its members, just one of the reasons why I recommend it, along with enabling you to make huge savings on the newest full-length Warhammer audiobooks. As an Audible member, you get one credit every month to use on any title across their entire premium selection, but clearly, credit's always best spent on those longer 9-hour-plus premium audiobooks. This month's pick was an easy one for me as we look to delve into the more darkened corners of Imperial life, the horrors that humanity face as citizens of the Imperium, from the vast cold reaches of space down into the depths of hive cities. So Warhammer Crime is the best place to find the reality for those ordinary humans in the Imperium. So two choices, Flesh and Steel and the Vorbis Conspiracy. I'll be telling you more about these at the end of the video today. You can start using Audible today with a free 30-day Audible trial to get yourself full access to thousands of audiobooks, originals, and podcasts, and all you need to do is visit audible.com/Lutin. And for those in the US, you can also text Lutin to 500-500. One of the things that I enjoy continually the most about humanity in the 41st millennium and the tortured souls who inhabit it is the disconnection between the reality as presented to us through the lens and vision of the Imperium and the reality for those who exist within it. We've often noted that 40k is meant to be a very bleak, dark parody of the human condition and civilization. This is established. What I often feel is somewhat less established, but I'm sure many of you know, is that the galaxy of M41 is largely presented to us through the eyes of the Imperium. All the lore, all the material that is given to us presented in fiction, this is why so much reference material like Xenology, Imperial Armor, is written almost in a report format. So it's not objective, and very often this leads to us building a fairly biased or distorted reality. It's not uncommon for us to have learned of characters who turn out to be far less than they were portrayed to be due to Imperial propaganda. Which is very interesting, because if the lore were written objectively and in a disconnected way, we wouldn't see instances like that, where it would be presented differently to us. Like a murder mystery movie where the audience know who the murderer is, and we enjoy watching the detective solve the murder through their skill and pragmatism. That's not what 40k is. 40k is the murder mystery where the detective is worn down through 20 years of bleak reality and has lost the will to try and understand the crimes they document. He's given up hope of making any kind of difference and accepts things for what they are. And when finally a case comes along that captures interest, it turns out to be far more horrific than originally intended. The outcome is grey and unsatisfactory, and we the audience only ever know as much as the protagonists themselves. For some people this is incredibly irritating. Some like their narratives to be all tied up, squared away, slotted into neat boxes with the proper labels, and then all placed into a bigger box that states the overall core category for its contents. And I can appreciate that. But this is not for me. I'm one of those people who really enjoys ambiguity. I like it when details are left out deliberately and endings are unclear. It gives room for your own imagination and speculation. In that same vein, I enjoy that the reality we see for humanity in the Imperium is unclear. To give a recent example, it's like the citizenry for Tertium in Dark Tide. For centuries, they believed they were sending their best out to fight the good fight in the name of the Emperor to the wars beyond their daily grind. Reports were infrequent, but always they were told of these fantastical achievements and the glory of the regiments out on the fringe realm of their system. But the reality was, of course, far from this truth, and it came back to not just haunt them, but potentially bring down their entire world and system. And then, of course, when the Inquisitor arrives, they themselves don't even know, necessarily, the specifics of what is happening. And in 40k, this is what I very much enjoy to see, is this disparity between the self-assured arrogance, which is how the Imperium presents itself, stacked against the depths of human despair, on a sliding scale from the medium levels of its vast hive cities, down to those who are condemned to languishing in eternal despair, the anonymous masses of Imperial citizens who will never know anything other than a life of hardship, toil, and suffering. The dark humour of the Imperium in M41 is of course quite blunt, in that for all the Xenos horrors of the galaxy, for all the nightmarish aliens and the ever-present threat of corruption, humanity remains its own worst enemy, so much so that for all of its fringe border wars which never end, there is an equally vicious unending war within its own walls. Discontent, traitors, renegades, heretics, uprisings, and simply those who in their own anguish and despair will open their souls to the darkest whisperings which bleed into our reality from the mirror realm adjacent to our own. As always, it's worth remembering that for those who live in the Imperium, the phrase jobs is relatively inaccurate. Most citizens' lives are dictated to them, and their work assignments are not what we would envisage as jobs. The Imperium, though, is vast, spread all throughout the galaxy, and dependent on the world you find yourself upon, the system it lies within, and the proximate distance from the more tightly controlled sectors of the Imperium, you may find more or less leeway when it comes to personal choice. Realms such as Ultramar enable a considerably broader range of independence for the citizenry than is commonplace elsewhere in the Imperium. As we've noted also before now, within the Imperium, there's no standardized currency system. To do so would be challenging, if not impossible, given the distance, scale, and instability of the Imperium as a whole. And while Hive Worlds may use localized forms of value, an endless list of ambiguously titled credit systems and guild-approved coinage, feudal planets often seem to still operate on a more basic barter system, supplemented with some perhaps rudimentary coinage issued by a ruling nobility. But there does exist some broader unit of value used by those who travel the wider galaxy. Inquisitors, rogue traders and the like use one of these known as the Throne Gelt, and this is as close to being a universal payment as exists. It's necessary so that they may pay for materials and services between one another and the systems they encounter, but how specifically this functions is unclear. For most humans, they will never leave the world they were born upon, for many they will never see the light of day even outside of their hive cities, and for any who do, it will likely be due to some indentured servitude, a soldier, a voidsman, agri-workers, and so on. Humans, in the eyes of the Imperial bureaucracy, are little more than currency. They're numbers on a data slate. They are the raw flesh matter material of the Imperium. Individuals are unimportant motes in the grand scale, and you are as much of a raw material asset to the Imperium as is ore, agri-produce, manufactured goods, ammunition, and other consumables. So let us return to the true horror of 40k. The life of those ordinary humans, or those living a life consumed by servitude to the Emperor. The lowly privileged, the necessarily skilled, the inescapable drudgery, the lack of hope. The acceptance of life so tortured and insignificant that many welcome death when it comes, while many more are left with minds unable to cope with the reality. All the while, the Imperium directs its arrogance and fury outwardly to the Xenos and the Heretic, but it is humanity itself which is as much to blame for the extreme levels of suffering inflicted upon the trillions of ordinary citizens across the entire galaxy, sometimes arguably more so than those who would seek its destruction. If you yourself stood upon the streets of a hive world, in a forge world, a feudal world in M41, how would you serve? What role would you see yourself in to survive? As always, if you have a worse 40k job in mind, throw it in the comments. Heads up, nothing related to sewerage and cleaning of things, we've heard it a billion times, and I covered it in video 1. We got it. Bad smelling things are unpleasant. If anybody can think of some truly creative, even perhaps speculative examples, it may make it into the next part of the series. So then, back we go into the horror. Recently, we discussed the region of space known as the Coronis Expanse. Far out on the edge of Imperial space, near the centre of this region, sits a giant red star known as SR-651. No one knows whether this system was originally inhabited or if it ever had really any other major planets, but now all that stands there is SR-651 and a vast ocean around it of dense asteroid fields. Scattered throughout these fields are the shattered, broken remains of void ships and fleets. Due to warp storms, it appears that periodically strange magnetic anomalies pull and sift the wreckage, so they collect in these massive graveyards of Imperial ships. Much like a river eddy, the Imperial materials gather in these swirling void pools, and over time, this has now created ship graveyards that are thousands of kilometers in dimension. Given the isolation of the Coronis Expanse and the fact that the system containing SR-651 lies not far from a major trade route, the needs to repair and improve star vessels, combined with its proximity to a busy shipping lane, gave rise to what would become a vast breaker yard. Now, you might imagine that within the Imperium, shipbreaking yards would be quite a well-established and a common thing, but actually not so much, because it is in fact quite rare that ships are deliberately mothballed, scrapped, and broken. And this is because of the vast amount of time and resources that go into the construction of any Imperial starship. It's worth to remember that the way the Imperium and the Mechanicus view hardware is not the same as we do in our time. Ships and material used by the Imperial faction or hierarchy are not something that will last 10, 20 years and then be scrapped. A significant amount of Imperial hardware will last centuries, millennia, or longer. Plus, there are many Imperial starship variants that they do not know how to build any longer, which means they must keep them in service as long as they can. So the only time you may see some small, localized breaking operations will be at the site of, say, vast space battles, and the ships which become broken, dead fields of Imperial technology, thus representing decades of construction filled with priceless, very often highly classified technology. Such operations would likely only occur under strict supervision, especially dependent on the origin of those involved. We might imagine Inquisitors, certainly Mechanicus, perhaps others, would oversee these operations. But out on the fringes of the galaxy, such factional representatives are far less present. It's more common that far smaller numbers of ships are lost out in the void or the warp, lost through battle, disaster, structural stresses, and as a result, some ships do just become untenable. But they're often abandoned, and approaching a ship for individual salvage has its own risks. Towing it to a world is very, very risky because lost, dead, and broken ships are often a calling card of Chaos, Xenos Corsairs, and the Tyranid Gene Stealer, or just other weird circumstances that are very dangerous. So again, unless there's a good reason to do so, dead ships that are adrift may well be left alone unless there's a specific reason for getting involved, especially if you were just a regular Imperial Navy vessel, not a well-equipped Astartes or Mechanicus salvage ship. So for these reasons and other, huge ship-breaking yards are not a common feature of the Imperium. They do exist, but it's not a regular industry, because by and large ships that are put out of service are either too damaged, too dangerous, or too difficult to recover. So an actual ship-breaking yard is as potentially bountiful as it is unusual. And this one was reportedly founded by an enterprising rogue trader, Iridas Holden, the scion of a powerful family from the Calyxus sector that was heavily invested in both shipyards and the salvage trade. After being battered into the SR-651 system by warp storms, Holden immediately sought a sheltered anchorage for the wounded ship, and while the crew and tech priests were busy with repairs, Holden took the opportunity to survey the system. He scanned everything within reach of his all-specs arrays and sent parties to search further afield. One of these discovered an independent salvage operation aboard an old station anchored close to the system's center. The voidsman agreed to return and meet with rogue trader Holden. After considerable discussions about the nature of the salvage operation in the system, it was revealed that over time, this system had become well known for its bountiful salvage prospects, and so numerous minor salvaging organizations had been operating in the SR-651 system for centuries. One practice was for rogue traders to establish teams of workers aboard some kind of temporary station until their masters retrieved them, or the very real possibility that they would just be killed by an exhaustive list of possible hazards, not limited to asteroids, pirates, Xenos, or just classic human error. Dan, don't remove that bulkhead! Rogue trader Holden could see this graveyard for the potential it held, and instead of these minor operations that sought to only use very minimal salvages, minor additional income streams for rogue traders, he had a grand vision. The salvage team they came across were of course reappropriated by Holden and pressed into service at his behest, as is pretty much the norm for rogue traders. It's not locked down or actively defended, the chances of the original owner discovering what happened are very minimal. Holden's plan was to turn SR-651 into a massive shipbreaking yard. He speculated that the only reason this hadn't already happened was that nobody wealthy enough or willing to gamble on such a prospect had come along until now. His plan was to reap massive wealth after investing in the construction of breaking yards in this system, upon which huge teams of voidsmen would recycle derelict ships and sell off components and raw materials, presumably to other rogue traders, or of course Forge Worlds and the Mechanicus, or simply to Hive Worlds, nobilities which required materials and so forth. His rationale was that with the extremely high attrition rate of Imperial ships passing through the Moor, and in general within the Coronis Expanse, coupled with deals he had made with some fellow rogue traders to tow in any decent-looking abandoned ships to the yards for scrap fees, he would then be able to establish a ship-breaking empire. With a flotilla of ships, tens of thousands of pressed men to work as shipbreakers, and a handful of lucrative salvage contracts, Holden claimed the entire system as his own. This is something rogue traders may do as and when it is available to them. Once their headquarters were established on a planet-sized jumble of asteroids and planetary debris held together in one of the system's gravitational sinks, Holden would set out to begin building the Empire. Unfortunately, even from the outset, it was quickly clear that this was going to be a disaster. Upon arrival at SR-651, many of the flotilla's ships, piloted by captains unfamiliar with the treacherous system, were lost to collisions and asteroid impacts. Once the operations headquarters were established and the temporary habs built, a brutal month-long warp storm swept through the system, disrupting asteroid orbits and sending shards of rock careening into ships at anchor. It was becoming clear why, until this point, no major operation had been established, and usually workers assigned to break vessels would do so in a very smaller cell of voidsmen left again by those rogue traders as something of a gamble. The chaotic events meant that for Holden, many thousands of workers were lost, as well as the habs that they had just established along with the supplies. This meant that for the survivors, they were now immediately beset with supply shortages, hunger rations, and very deadly working conditions. This quickly led to riots by the voidsmen and constant work strikes. Of course, these were going to be brutally and quickly suppressed, but the operation was very fast disintegrating. Holden would attempt to hold things together, as well as his investments, so far, but once word was out among other ports in the system, his name was quickly only spoken of with the delight in his downfall or rage at this incompetence by other rogue traders. Because often, if a rogue trader is seen to fall from grace, others are going to pounce on the opportunity to secure their assets, their trading routes, very quickly. And this was much the case for Holden and his wider household family, where sadly the majority of them would end up being sold into indentured servitude to account for his loans, his ships and contracts being appropriated. Finally, in the midst of this chaos, the crew of his own ship would mutiny and kill Holden and his officers. So now in command of a well-equipped void ship and possessing an intimate knowledge of the systems and its hazards, one of these voidsmen aboard his ship picked up where the unfortunate Holden had left off. It was none other than the voidsman that they had originally encountered in the fields of wreckage at that proto-breaking yard, one Hargoth Agamar. Hargoth was no officer. He was a voidsman. He was a plain worker, like all those who had survived. And so he made them a straightforward offer. Those who would stay and work would be provided shelter, food, and a cut of the profits. Those who wished to leave would be given a ship and sent on their way. So months of dangerous, intense and painful labour followed. They attempted to salvage and secure the installation with what few supplies they had left. The makeshift temporary habitats were shored up and adapted, if not into permanent, at least livable conditions. It was a far smaller operation than Holden had planned, but at least it was workable. They began by towing scraps around the system for salvage and building materials. Hargoth made deals with surrounding systems, trading valuable ship parts and raw materials for food and supplies. And to the surprise of Hargoth and his followers, contract ships for salvage breaking began to arrive. This became a steady process, and it turned out these were arrangements that had been made by Holden. His contacts were apparently entirely unaware of the change in the breaking yard ownership. So Hargoth and co. soon found themselves with a pretty stable salvage business. Tragically, but not unusually though, in the short time after, when things were going pretty well, Hargoth and many voidsmen were lost traversing the Moor. It's not uncommon, as it remains one of the most dangerous routes of passage within the Imperial Galaxy, and many who were left in the breaking yards then decided to strip the remaining ships of whatever they could of the highest value and disappear out of sight and record. Of the remaining minimal workers, who were completely incapable of maintaining the vision of the operation, as Hargoth had been the one organising the ramshackle workforce, without him it quickly collapsed in short order. So why are the breaking yards such a harsh job for human workers? Well, it's because of what came after. Instead of a well-organised ship-breaking operation with contracts and contacts to bring in ships and export valuable hardware and materials, the breaking yards in the aftermath of this collapse became little more than a hellish, void-based industrial prison. It now holds the poorest, the most desperate and condemned of people within the Coronis Expanse. Within the cold, isolated and extremely dangerous breaking yards, these individuals toil away for uncounted hours, wearing heavily worn, patched up void suits, barely operational salvage equipment. Many of the individuals here are regularly never seen again. But for those who live here, they work to breaking point as they blindly attempt to secure high value assets by tearing ships apart piece by piece. Much like elsewhere in the Imperium, operations staffed by the lost, the desperate and the condemned carry an unpleasantly high mortality rate. Deaths are so common as to be trivial. Life is cheap, and over time everyone who works here steadily becomes sick as well from radiation poisoning and other unnamed extremely hazardous materials used in building void ships. What had been for Hargoth and the Voidsmen a place of hope and potential had collapsed into one of exploitation, suffering and despair. Within the breaking yards sits what was once to be the central hub of the operations, now known as the receiving yard. It is identified as a massive spindle-shaped space station 30 kilometers long. Incoming vessels are processed and inspected here before being sent into the breaking yards for salvage. The spindle contains the old administrative offices, along with living quarters for the clerks, along with the yard foreman and other enforcers. Also, a bustling marketplace dominates the central decks of the station, where ship components from the breaking yards are sold to anyone with the thrones to purchase them. Everything from Auspex array lenses to warp drives and Gellar-filled generators can be had. The condition and reliability of those pieces of hardware? That's buyer beware. They don't come with a warranty or returns policy, that's for sure. Sometimes if a vessel was relatively undamaged but had been abandoned for some other reason, this can in fact lead to entire ship hulls becoming available. These bare hulls are typically stripped of all primary hardware, including their engines and weapon systems. A decent conditioned hull, though, is of considerable value. They're not easily nor quickly fabricated by the Imperium, and such a find would be ideal for a rogue trader who wants a new vessel as a special project or a highly dangerous task for a stripped down ship. The breaking yards themselves now appear as a loosely connected structure of massive chains of hundreds of kilometers of flexible, semi-rigid pressure corridors, which connect the disparate pieces of the complex. Traversing them, though, is of course wildly dangerous, as at any time stray debris could theoretically damage them. Stationary, sizable asteroids are also connected to the pathways, and rough collections of ramshackle hangars and workshops sit upon them, bashed together from hull plates and other random detritus. Leaky, unshielded pressure domes and temporary emergency habitats make up the living quarters for those workers lucky enough to have them. Even with their stagnant, poorly recycled atmospheres that run a high risk of depressurizing or imploding without warning, they're still said to be preferable to sleeping aboard one of the space hulks in a vac suit or in a makeshift hovel built from the scavenged cockpit of a gun cutter, as sadly many do. The entire place is full of wretched, hollow-eyed people and has the look and feel of a huge, dangerous slum. It's dominated by the hulking shapes of derelict void ships and is always lit by glaring floodlights and the glittering sparks of cutting torches. Whilst one might assume this facility would be subjected to constant raids by pirates and other undesirables, including potentially Xenos, it actually happens relatively infrequently. Because, for starters, the breaking yard itself is wildly dangerous to just navigate and emerge unscathed. Despite the workers' hamps being little more than slums as well, the actual defensive capabilities of the yards is considerable. One of the benefits of stripping down Imperial ships is that they now have access to hundreds of dismounted macro batteries and lances, along with thousands of close defense turrets. And these have been steadily mounted all around the facility and secured within orbiting rocks and asteroids. These are manned at all times by a rotation of trained gun crew and coordinated from a salvaged ship's bridge, improvised as a command and communication center. This allows the yards to defend themselves and the receiving yard at both short and long range. The yards also maintain a small ragged fleet of fast defense monitors and inter-system ships, not to mention there are usually some rogue traders hanging around who likely would be less than impressed to have their time wasted or ships damaged by some upstart pirates or orcs who have attempted unsurprisingly to raid the yards many times, always being repelled. For whatever reason though, ownership of the yards has consistently proven to be a folly for any who attempts to expand its operation. Many have tried over the years, but it always ends in disaster. Rogue traders who have attempted to build their own empire upon Holden's vision inevitably end up in a state of humiliation and financial collapse. The breaking yard facility of the Cronus Expanse seems destined to survive in a state of perpetual anarchy, in the truest sense of the definition. The workers here exist with no laws or established rules, no official hierarchical leadership structure. It's true that periodically groups may spring up, rogue traders may attempt to seize power, claim the yards for themselves, or to do things differently, but whenever this happens, things inevitably tend to always slip back into a state whereby those who survive in the yard answer to only one source of power, themselves. Hive worlds remain one of the core planetary types for the Imperium of Mankind. Throughout the galaxy exist planets which, over many thousands of years of human habitation, have steadily concentrated their habitation in one vast megacity known as a hive. These have been built upon and above existing structures for millennia, and often the absolute lowest levels may contain traces of the original colonists who arrived upon a world prior even to the Age of Strife. Yet for many hive worlds, the hive city remains near enough the only habitable place remaining on a planet. This is because many hive planets have suffered total ecological collapse long ago, and the surface of worlds now exists as a desert, irradiated wasteland, or just oceans of waste and contamination, making the very surface level atmosphere unbreathable. There are, though, those who exist out there among these ashen wastes, and for whom maintaining their existence is an unending misery, but for whom returning to the hive city is equally unappealing and dangerous. The surroundings of many hives are devoid of any natural life whatsoever, and this is because they suffer millennia of pollution and exploitation of resources, thus leaving them as little more than wastelands of polluted, sometimes irradiated ash, referred to often as unsurprisingly the ashen wastes. But human figures still exist here, either in micro-settlements or in and around the base external areas of the hive itself, perhaps salvaging scrap material or making repairs to pipelines and transport tubes. Many worlds can contain hidden rewards in the form of available scrap or even lost technology, and those who scout the wasteland may be lucky enough to venture upon a rich oxide vein or accumulation of valuable chemicals having leached from bedrock below. These pockets can be mined or collected for return and processing within the hive. But the nomadic tribes who stalk the ashen wastes are feared by many, often mistaken for any number of odd, bizarre characters, mutants, drudges, scavies, and wasters. But nobody is really sure if they're merely outcasts from the hive city or if their origin is more ancient. They appear humanoid, but from wherever they originate, they clearly have diverged from the humans of the Imperium who dwell within hive cities. Their lives are brutally harsh, for life in the toxin, ash and wastelands of hive worlds is not one any should wish for. Some planets have extremely thin atmospheres outside of a hive city itself, and many more are badly irradiated or otherwise saturated with chemical pollutants. Violent storms are a constant feature of life for those souls who have made the wasteland their home. Rolling clouds appear out of nowhere and blot all light from the skies. Some have even suggested, though, that just as the nomadic wastelanders have somehow become at one with their environment, they also can have an affinity to call upon such storms to protect themselves or to consume their enemies. The nomadic inhabitants of the toxic wastelands move around likely out of necessity, but some have semi-permanent habitation or at least have familiar places they may revisit to occupy for some time. Some are seen to inhabit ancient destroyed factories on the outskirts of far sprawling hive cities. Once busy industrial centres are now silent but for the irradiated winds that cast through the immense creaking, steadily disintegrating structures. For whatever reason, the nomads ended up living in the wasteland, and despite adapting to its conditions, it remains a brutally unforgiving environment. Clean hydration is undoubtedly in short supply, but much remains unknown about their affinity for the insectoid life that exists among the wastes. Nomads are commonly seen clad in rags called hazarn, or ash cloaks, to both protect themselves and so as to blend in with their barren surroundings. They'll also wear all-over masks equipped with protective lenses and filtration pipes, obviously so as to protect against the bright kaleidoscopic glare that can reflect from the wastelands and the toxic atmosphere that hangs at a surface level. However they came to be and whatever their origin, life outside of a hive city on any world is going to be bleak, hard, and entirely unforgiving. Protecting yourself from the intense toxic pollution, your body already likely mutated and poisoned over the years, strange creatures who stalk the wastelands, some that you might use, others avoided at all costs. Gangs who patrol territory looking for scrap materials or transporting shipments of materials between hive cities. Compared to the nomads, though, few hive workers would be able to survive much longer than a single day if thrown out into the freezing wastelands, and as for as horrific an environment as it must be to exist in, the nomadic tribal humanoids of the Ashen Wastes have adapted well enough to be a permanent feature. Some are even strong enough to mount raids upon gangs or traders who do not see fit to adequately protect themselves. It is a bleak and dangerous existence, and one can only consider what is their goal beyond bare survival. They sift through the scraps of a world that some speculate was once their own. How did they come to be? Are they simply exiled hive citizens? Or is their origin more curious and disturbing? Is there any possibility that they are still the descendants of the original colonists of a world? One of the most troubling problems for the traitors after the heresy was, of course, how do we use the warp? Unsurprisingly, when you consider the fact that heretics have made their bed with chaos, their options are different compared with the mere mortals of the Imperium. Chaos forces may use navigators, but they can acquire or hire sorcerers, bound demons, the possessed, to aid them in navigating the warp. It's still a hellish realm, but when you consider that the traitors are the active servants to the horrors of the warp, there's less for them to worry about than the humans of the Imperium. They may well have some protection, and assistance even, from the great entities they serve in protecting from the more irrational and destructive malevolent entities who exist within warp space. But with that said, of course there are still problems, especially if you were, say, worshippers of one specific chaos god, and you then encountered beings of a different chaos power. So it's not to say there are not extreme hazards. And then, of course, there's just the matter of the warp itself. It's not described as the Sea of Souls for no reason. The warp is a powerful realm where just travelling through it is extremely hazardous. Vast gravitational eddies, floating debris, shattered materials, and innumerable other dangers. And that's before you begin to worry about all the horrors within. And then, of course, there's the time issue. For the Imperium, finding your way efficiently through the warp is a strong reason why having a highly experienced navigator who knows how to guide the ship through the tempest of the warp is very valuable. The less time in the warp is always for the betterment of all. For the traitors, there are some who exist permanently on the fringes of the warp, the great rift straddling a life between real space and the Immaterium. For them, what appears as a short trip into the warp could actually see centuries pass, and other Chaos Marines may spend considerable amounts of time actually in the warp itself. For many, this may mean they have lost all comprehension of relatable time. What feels like years for them may be millennia in real space. And it's important to remember that while Astartes have huge fleets of ships, the Astartes are not the direct crew for these vessels. They have the Imperial Navy for this role, so nearly all Imperial ships are crewed by ordinary humans. And during the Heresy, we often saw just what could happen to those ordinary humans aboard Chaos vessels. One of the best examples likely being the commanding officer of the World Eater's flagship Conqueror, one Lotara Saren. She was one of the youngest ship officers in the Imperium, and despite being a lowly normal human, she'd earned a limited degree of respect within the World Eaters, even wearing their Bloody Hand honour emblem upon her white officer's jacket, even on speaking terms with Angron himself, it said. And so, there is of course this interim period during the Heresy, where the Astartes, the traitors, they decided they didn't want to serve under the Emperor and sought to overthrow him by force. The point being, for the ordinary humans crewing the Astartes vessels, many who had likely only served with one legion and were fairly loyal to them, didn't perhaps understand really what they were getting into. Of course, turning against the Emperor is no small thing, but in the Heresy, surprisingly, humans didn't seem quite as blinkered as they are in M41 when it comes to turning away from the Emperor, because it's important to remember that really the cult of the Imperium, the Ecclesiarchy, didn't exist yet. The Emperor was just this guy that people really believed in. He was the saviour of humanity, but the idea of him being a god to worship and follow beyond all others had not really set in stone as it does by M41. Also, initially, things aboard the ships of the traders didn't really particularly change. They travelled around, attacked worlds. For the ordinary crew, including their navigators, this seemed pretty business as usual. But by the time of the Siege of Terra, things had changed considerably. The Conqueror, for example, had now fallen under the influence of Khorne. The very corridors and spaces within it were now a blood-soaked, hostile environment to the crew, screaming constantly heard throughout. Much to the frustration of officers like Saren, this led to a rapid depletion of supplies and manpower, often because of traitor Astartes just killing them on the slightest whim. And by this time, an exhausted, filthy, but still apparently sane Saren was still in command of the corrupted Conqueror, and by now was desperately trying to hold the ship together despite random massacres being committed by Angron and the World Eaters. She was even concerned they might murder the tech priests, keeping the Conqueror's reactor stable. Saren, like many crew of the traitor vessels, had become sickly and a broken shadow of her former self due to the consistent obscenities being committed aboard the ships. She now commanded all but just a skeleton crew on what was a mutated ship of horrors. Saren, though, had become all but a wraith, conjured by the now sentient machine spirit of the Conqueror, doomed to serve aboard the damned vessel for eternity. The real Lotara had long since fused with the vessel and was now in a state of undeath. In the period after the heresy, for those serving aboard traitor vessels, it's not something any really should be wishing for. Many ships will have some semblance of self-awareness, the machine spirits awakened by the powers of the warp, others will have very, very high crew turnover, replenished by capturing Imperial vessels and stealing their crew, or raids on Imperial worlds. For humans serving aboard any Chaos ship will of course be a full nightmare. Torture, random execution, the very ship itself a hostile place which could reach out, figuratively, and tear your limbs clean off. Wordbearers, for example, have been known to pack their holds full of potential human sacrifices to protect them whilst travelling through the warp. Others will literally use humans aboard them as the flesh matter for endless nightmarish rituals. So the less said about being aboard a Nightlord ship, the better. But what of navigators? Well, some navigators did willingly stay operational post-heresy, although this were likely more often the case with traitors who didn't throw themselves all in with the powers that be. Navigators from this time, or their descendants, are often afforded a modicum of respect and safety aboard a traitor vessel because of their high value, far more than ordinary humans. They'll likely be allowed to remain in their accommodations higher atop the ship so as to not witness the full horror taking place in the lower decks. But still, this is not to say that the environment itself is still not a total nightmare for them. Their existence is a continually terrifying ordeal, especially for those navigators who have been captured and forced into servitude aboard traitor vessels. Their life hereon will vary considerably, and some ships may treat the navigator quite well, understanding their value to the operation of the ship. Others are just blinded by their slide into heresy, and even for one as valuable and rare as a navigator, they won't escape the cruelty, the torment, the mutational aspects of the Chaos Corrupted Marines. Others, like we say, may be descendants, scions, serving participants, even aboard ships that are blighted by, say, the touch of Nurgle. Their bodies twisted, mutated into bizarre, foul abominations. While some may attempt to cut out a shroud of their once held high positions that demanded respect and carried considerable power aboard the ships of the Imperial Navy, any who serve aboard the ships of the traitors know that this is nothing more than play acting. None are given the same respect or care that they would have been in serving aboard Imperial ships. The traitors are left to sift through the detritus to acquire what they need, the scavenged, the scraps, the broken, the weak, the lost. And so for navigators aboard traitor vessels, they may sometimes feel they have a role to play, a figure of importance, a position that still counts for something. This may be true, but beyond this, their lives exist in a state of pointless despair by degrees. Just like the crew, they could be extinguished at any moment, something that would be all but entirely unthinkable aboard the ships of the Imperial Navy. Now, we have covered on a separate video the horror of the fate for those condemned by the Sororitas, known as Arcoflagellation and the Penitent Engine, plus of course, Anchorites. All of this comes under the banner of the role of a penitent, and the extreme nature of the punishments is designed to purge a heretic's soul. It's debated as to the reasoning behind this. Some might argue it's a last attempt for an individual to save themselves, others maintain it's so that they may strengthen the Emperor when they eventually die. These damned souls condemned to arcoflagellation will undergo extensive physical surgery as well as mental reprogramming, thus turning them into a berserker servitor war machine. Their arms or hands are nearly always amputated, or in the more brutal adaptations, the hands are split open, and these modifications allow electrically charged flails to be embedded into the body's structure. A pacification helmet is connected directly into the brain and spinal cord to set the condemned into a state of passive calm and limited awareness. Their minds will then be continually bombarded with holy images, scripture, and verses. pictures of saints' hymnals and prayers. After this, they're inevitably in a fairly destroyed state, and are left in this neutral stage of semi-consciousness, kept in storage areas intravenously fed nutrients, awaiting such a time as to when they're required. They retain basic motor functions in this state and are shufflingly moved from one place to another. Some can still respond to basic verbal commands of a controlling ecclesiarchy or designated inquisitor. These are useful for infiltration operations when a command such as follow or wait can be used. When required for combat though, the pacification helm is deactivated by means of a trigger word, which can be either given verbally or psychically through telepathic means. And this is when the previously passive cyborg becomes one of the most terrifying creations of the Imperium. Charging towards its enemy, screeching, wailing in agony, and flailing its arms about, the Arcoflagellant exists now only to destroy all that it sees. And once unleashed, they are near to unstoppable, their bodies embedded with combat stimulants which continually drive them forward with stamina, awareness boosters, painkillers, and adrenaline, leaving them unable to feel or sense much of anything. An Arcoflagellant will throw itself at its enemy no matter what, and the only thing capable of stopping it is complete physical destruction. They become a pure distillation of psychopathic rage, lashing, flailing creatures of death, insatiable, unstoppable, uncaring, unthinking. Imperials obviously hold no consideration for the survival of Arcoflagellant units. They are by design completely expendable. They're intended to cause sheer terror in those they are unleashed against, plus of course, sometimes inevitable collateral damage of innocents. And while the control of an Arcoflagellant can mark nearby units as friendly, which would then be ignored by the Arcoflagellant, any innocents who happen to run into it by unfortunate chance would be indiscriminately lashed to pieces. Arcoflagellants are though poorly armoured, and while their bodies are reinforced with implants, these will do little against some Xenos weaponry. So they're best used by Inquisitors within the close quarter environments of a hive city, where they might encounter gang forces, ordinary human cults, and general bands of undesirables, who do not appreciate the presence of an Inquisitor. Arcoflagellants are ideal for such places. They're in very close quarters, facing down poorly equipped, highly motivated individuals, and against the kind of human scum an Inquisitor may encounter, an unleashed Arcoflagellant can inflict appalling damage and complete mind-breaking terror. Even a single Arcoflagellant is a significant force multiplier for a singular Inquisitor, or more likely their agents, descending into the darkness of the lower levels of a hive world. So an Arcoflagellant, while impressively brutal, are in fact a miserable distillation of mankind's combined ignorance, fear, and cruelty. So it is perhaps fitting that they are one of the weapons of the Adeptus Ministorum. Not to be outdone, of course, the Sisters of Battle, with their insane penchant for self-abasement, devised an equally horrific punishment for heretics, or just sororitas who have failed in the line of duty, and more importantly, the eyes of the Emperor. Plus, of course, the Ministerium must continually engage in visible demonstrations of punishment toward those who would dare to threaten its sanctity, particularly in M41. Uprisings of the faithless across the Imperium remain a constant scourge. It has been, after all, many millennia since the Emperor walked among humankind, and with each year that passes, there will always be those for whom doubt creeps into the mind. So governors and ruling noble families know that these must be promptly dealt with by their militia or enforcers, or face loss of their authority and planet-wide lockdowns, not to mention likely delegations of the Ecclesiarchy or Sororitas who will deal punishment, perhaps to the higher-ups themselves, to remind them of just who they serve and to demonstrate to the populace that none may escape penance in the name of the Emperor. There will be many carefully designed methods to make this point all too clear. Some will be tailored to the specific traits of a world and its flora or fauna, other times a simple burning might suffice. Bone-crushing repentance wheels or an agonizing evisceration, care of the dreaded rat pits. Then there is of course the Arcoflagellation as discussed, but what if you wanted to go further? Well, there is of course an option for that. For those guilty of the most offensive crimes, for the heretics and the true sinners, they'll be dragged to the darkest dungeons beneath the cathedrums of the Ecclesiarchy, to the darkened halls where tortured screams echo throughout the ornate arched sanctuaries. Penitent engines are reserved for the truly abominable sinners. This means that the role of a penitent pilot is often reserved for high-ranking officials, members of the Ecclesiarchy, even members of the Sororitas. Somewhat similarly to an Arcoflagellant, they'll be hardwired with cybernetic implants, but then in this instance, they'll be interfaced with a mechanical framework their brain cortex and optical nerves connected through the engine's torment amplifiers spliced into a sinner's synapses. Chemical injectors also are implanted into their spines, again similarly to the archoflagellant. But unlike the archoflagellant, who are stripped of all thought and deluged with spiritual visions, those mounted upon a penitent engine will be consumingly saturated with senses of physical pain and spiritual guilt, as wave after unending wave of sensory overload crashes into their mind and body. In fact, it's said that it is often pain itself which drives the penitent engine's actuators and servos. A machine powered by pain and suffering somehow seems disturbingly similar to a Drakkari creation. Yet with seemingly no self-awareness to this comparison, penitent engines are commonly used by the Ecclesiarchy. Not least because they're powerful machines which will charge towards an enemy, ignoring all danger. They know that only via death of their enemy and themselves can they earn absolution. More disturbingly, it's said that a penitent engine upon nearing enemy will alter the chemical synaptic inputs of the pilot, that they may then see their own face upon the enemy. Their minds now so long tortured by pain, and as to their guilt, their minds are tortured into hating themselves with such a fury and bitterness for their heretical shortcomings that they will thrash, burn through the enemy with a mindless, irrational rage that could only be compared to white-hot metal. The arms of these engines are mounted with immense promethium flamethrowers to shower their foes with liquid fuel, sticking all over an enemy and burning them with high intensity. Paired with this are huge circular buzzsaw blades or swirling flails, which can carve through or batter to pieces an enemy into a crushed, carved, mushed paste. But penitent engines are rarely seen in battle unless they're accompanied by the Sisters of Battle. And this is because the Sororitas consider it their sacred duty to bear witness to these great machines charging into the fires of combat. They believe it to be a valuable lesson for the soul to observe their fallen brothers and sisters to atone for their past sins, where every slain foe by a penitent engine's brutal juggernaut only proves to them that this is truly a holy, righteous form of punishment. But then, of course, there's the Anchorites. The Sororitas, as noted, are adept at punishments designed for themselves, and one such punishment for the sisters is that known as the Repentia. A Repentia are sisters who have already crossed an unacceptable line of failure in the eyes of their sisters, and so they seek to cleanse themselves of their sins in the fire of battle. They'll wear no armour, often seen in little more than rags, carrying gigantic chainswords. They charge across battlefields with only the faith of the Emperor to protect them. The goal of all Repentia is not necessarily punishment as such, it's the idea to redeem themselves in the eyes of their sisters and of course the Emperor. Unsurprisingly, few achieve this goal. Most will die in battle. But those few who do succeed will often then become faithful champions of the Sororitas again through their exceptional display of redemption. They may even be revered by other sisters who believe them to be chosen or saved for glory, guided by the Emperor through this darkest time of weakness back into the path of the light. This is seen as a very good thing. The sisters, disturbingly for this reason, may subject themselves to extremely harsh judgment in their everyday actions, knowing for some they're even actually looking really for an excuse so that they may legitimately become Repentia. Their belief and hope is that in doing so they may receive the guidance of the Emperor and prove their true faith, which is very disturbing. But some Repentia don't wish for salvation, some just truly strayed from the path of the light of their own free will. Some may even harbour doubts in their faith and even wish to abscond from the Sororitas. Thus, some Repentia may not go willing into the arms of the Emperor. Charging into near certain death is not how they might choose to use the last of their life. And so while some Repentia will actively charge into the enemy, others are kept in line from a sister superior. But this is never an airtight solution amid the chaos of a battlefield, and some Repentia may still attempt to flee, to escape from the iron grip of the Ecclesiarchy upon their lives, but for those who attempt this, the punishment is severe. They face becoming the most tortured souls beyond that of an archoflagellant or penitent engine. They will become Anchorites, for the rest of their living days imprisoned within mortifiers. These are similar to penitent engines, but they have additional elements. Firstly, the neurological arrays are amplified and metal holds driven through the skeletal structure of the sister, pinning her into the mortifier framework or casket. This leaves her unable to move at all. Then a hood is placed over her, designed to prevent any words of piety being heard by the sister. She does not even deserve to overhear them. But for those sisters condemned of actively betraying their own, they face being entombed within a specially designed adamantine coffin. This sarcophagus is designed to protect the condemned sororitas so that they might continue to endure their punishment and deny them the blissful release of death. These anchorites will never see outside their coffins again, nor will any hear their screams. They're sealed in behind lifeless masks of penance, forced to face their torment in complete, absolute isolation, enduring years or sometimes decades of mental, physical suffering before their end. The war machines known as mortifiers will always be placed on the front lines. They will be amplified into a zealous rage of personal suffering and self-loathing. Unlike penitent engines, mortifiers contain such damaged, long-suffering pilots, they're often seen to stagger around awkwardly. They'll still charge forward in a strange method of motion due to the waves of anguish and pain sweeping through the sister's body. Thus, the machines often look as if they're on the verge of malfunction, which to some degrees they are. And this makes them all the more terrifying, as they're a truly bizarre sight to behold, as they go jittering and staggering across the field, firing their heavy bolters and flamers, but their core drive is to reach the enemy, to tirelessly thrash themselves against the enemy in a mutilating frenzy of whirling, beating and crushing, tearing their enemy apart like crazed horrors. Except that unlike penitents and archoflagellants, there's no easy self-destructive release for the mortifiers. They will survive for many more battles, and whenever they finally do become damaged enough to fall in battle, they will become overwhelmed with the all-consuming sense of suffering that continues to await them. They will become overwhelmed with the all-consuming sense that there will be no redemption for them, and they know that only darkness and eternal suffering continues to await them. The Emperor will not redeem their soul, and this sends them into a last apocalyptic whirlwind of devastation, slaughtering any nearby in a final bloodthirsting rage before they're finally put down. The penitent punishments of the Ecclesiarchy and the Sororitas are among some of the most appalling tasks assigned to those within the Imperium. For death will not come soon, their suffering exists as both penance and as an example to the faithful to never doubt, never stumble in your duty, always stay true to the cause and the path set by the Emperor. The Scitarii are the bulk infantry force of the Mechanicus. These legions of troops go to war alongside the towering god machines of the Forge Worlds, at the behest of the Tech Priests. They're the frontline vanguard forces, and none fit this description better than, of course, the Scitarii Vanguard themselves. Now, the Scitarii are technically still human, yet unsurprisingly, as many contingent elements of the Mechanicus, they're very heavily augmented. The Tech Priests of Mars do not see the organic form as sacred in any sense. To them, the flesh literally is weak, and therefore it should be replaced. This is not simply due to the physical, though. People often misunderstand the Mechanicus in this regard. The fact that the Mechanicus cybernetically enhance themselves is not just because they want to be stronger, more efficient, and out of some desire to be more machine. This is all true, but it's not the entire meaning. The reason as to why the Mechanicus seek to upgrade themselves in this way is always due to this overarching principle of the preservation of knowledge. The strength, efficiency, and longevity of their cybernetic upgrades enables them to live longer, be more resilient in an extremely hostile galaxy, and to retain knowledge, to protect knowledge. This outlook, though, has steadily given rise to a very strong disregard for the organic, a cold, emotionless perspective that sees the organic in the same way that ordinary humans view the machine, something that can be replaced, repaired, discarded very easily. The Mechanicus view the flesh with as little emotion as humans see ordinary tools and machinery. So to this end, Tech Priests, servants of the Mechanicus and the Scitarii will be cybernetically upgraded until they're fit for purpose. No care or consideration given to the individual. They will conform to their necessary role, purpose and task. Nothing else is relevant. As a consequence, some might describe the Scitarii legions as less than human. But this isn't really a slur. Their meaning is just that the Scitarii are in fact far more deadly. For the Scitarii are forged from various human stock. Their base origin is not really seen as relevant. Some are natural born, others are cloned vat born, some are even mind wiped convicts and warriors without a war to fight. But unlike servitors, nearly all Scitarii will retain some sense of higher brain function to enable them to process and make reasonable decisions with more complex battlefield commands. On the other hand, unfortunately very much like servitors, after they have been processed, Scitarii appear with taut, deteriorated skin, their flesh is penetrated by sutured cybernetics, and their body is systematically dotted with ceramic valves and adamantium sockets wrapped with winding artificial threads of translucent muscles. Their brains will also commonly have undergone some surgery with artificial implanted neurocircuitry. Skitari adaptations are far from consistent in terms of quality. They may have the most temporary and simplistic organ replacements, but then also quantum processors in their neurosystems. On top of their endless training, Skitari undergo genetic enhancement programs that develop their strength and aggression, and they're physically and cybernetically augmented to further these traits, as well as to ensure, of course, unswerving loyalty to Mars. All Skitari, as part of their neural adaptations, will naturally have their minds wiped of both emotion and individual personality, because why not? They'll then be implanted with mental directives designed to ensure that they follow the orders of their commanding tech priest without question, not dissimilarly to the robots of the Mechanicus. Some may even be so heavily adapted that they're quite literally remote-controlled units. But most will have mind adaptations to ensure that they're overflowing with rage and the wrath of the Omnissiah. But a commander will retain a higher level of control and calm. All as well will be imbued with an ability to understand binary, which is critical to the Mechanicus noosphere communication and enables commands to be sent and understood by the Skitari's augmented cerebral cortices nearly instantaneously. This allows them to operate with a remarkable degree of cooperation, highly necessary for what is essentially a raging horde of servitors. But the way in which they're controlled is, again, actually not dissimilar to the way Tyranid control their mass forces. But within the Skitari, one specifically unpleasant designation are those known as the Vanguard. To some, they're known as Rad Troopers. They're armed with some of the most harmful and destructive weaponry available for infantry in the Imperium. They bring the power and hostility of the Mechanicus to any world that they're deployed upon. And the Vanguard are equipped with these so-called radium weapons that are in fact so volatile they will almost always eventually kill those who carry them into battle. Their deceptive baroque beauty belies a singularly horrific function, not only to strike and deal harm to their enemies, but to deliberately render the battlefield as deadly as the irradiated wastelands of Mars. Their weapons are basically extremely radioactive, to the point where it damages themselves and everything around them. For the enemies who face down the Vanguard and survive for another day, they face a far more unpleasant, painful, and altogether nightmarish fate, as they'll soon find their flesh blackening and sloughing away from their body, their bodies unable to absorb any pain relief or medicine, they'll steadily deteriorate until all their systems within their body collapse. And the Vanguard are dangerous even for their own allies. For any guardsmen who would be unlucky enough to come into close contact with the Skitari troops, many will feel instantly dizzy and unwell, vomiting will follow, and often they might take weeks to fully recover, if at all. And for any who would be stationed near to a unit of Vanguard for the long term, this is as good as a death sentence. So while the Vanguard are theoretically safe themselves within their armour, their physical appearance tells a different story. But few outside of their own units will ever witness this. Because most are hairless, their skin has become pockmarked with sores, their entire bodies seeming in a state of continual deterioration, likely only kept operational thanks to the adaptations of the Mechanicus. Their continual suffering appears to be a price they're quite willing to pay for their devotion to the Machine God. Their fearsome reputation precedes the Vanguard wherever they go, and their presence recalls some of the most terrifying weapons used by Astartes' destroyer squads of the Heresy. Vanguard troopers' signature rad carbines unleash volleys of hyper-irradiated shots that can apparently bring down any target. Their rad poisoning shells contaminate the air and the ground, and their reputation combined with the weaponry means that Skitari Vanguard are assigned to the most hazardous war zones in the galaxy, yet always they're seen to carry out their engagements in solemn silence, fighting to the last in the name of their inhuman god. The Rad Troopers are in more ways than one, the destroyers of worlds. Now, we have looked periodically at the horror of human processing in relative brief, but people really seem to have a lot of interest in the varying roles, purposes, and consequences of the macabre role of corpse or not-so-corpse processing in the Imperial worlds. So I figured as people seem taken with this, we would consider it a little further. Within Imperial Hive cities, very often specific roles are assigned to what are referred to as guilds. In human history, guilds began to appear within a locality to represent specific areas of industry or commerce. They arose out of a need to maintain a consistent standard within their goods so as to better maintain and set trading practices and rates within an industry, thus ensuring better and more stable prices for their members of that locality. Of course, over time, this would also mean they began to hold a level of power within a region and could exert some over local authorities. Sometimes this was for the betterment of all, sometimes purely out of the interests of guild members. In some towns, for example, multiple guilds would exist for different industries, and they might be responsible together for the upkeep of some city defences, contributing to the greater good, as it were. Incidentally, history is fun, and I have literally visited some ancient towns in Europe where this practice is documented, and you can see and visit ancient city wall towers and keeps that still exist and were maintained in this way. Also, would you like some more history like this from me and other vids? Let me know in the comments. Now, in our own history, unsurprisingly, guilds sought over time to monopolise and exert too much control. Not entirely dissimilar, it should be also noted, to how businesses can sometimes buy out or crush smaller enterprises or individuals that could threaten their interests. Well, the same can be said for guilds. And within the hive cities of the Imperium, you'll often see a variety of guilds in operation, some for world-specific resources, others more general, like guilds of coin, air, water, promethium. One of the most common and significant guilds for any hive world are going to be those involved in human processing. And this can vary, of course, when it comes to the specifics, but the Imperium is so vast, it's not going to be a default set of guilds for every world. But however you want to cut it, operating in the human processing section of hive guilds is never going to be a pleasant task, and for some more than others, this can lead to a slide into worship of the more diabolical powers. For those of the Corpse Guild, it's sometimes possible they slide into the spotlight of the Blood God, as the Hive's insatiable desire for the strangely addictive starchy cubes which form a dietary supplement for Hive citizens. But I'll repeat what I've noted before now, that it's no mystery that Corpse Starch for the Imperium is effectively Soylent Green. Sorry spoilers if you've waited until now to find out about the seminal piece of early 70s sci-fi. It's of course a bleak, dark, dystopian future which was typical of 70s science fiction. And sadly, we saw far fewer of these reflective works after the like of, say, Star Wars, which ensured that the vast majority of the genre which followed would lean more in the direction of blasty lasers and less toward more cerebral speculations about post-20th century dystopian social commentary. Anyway, the point is, like with many things in 40k, it's clear where Corpse Starch takes its pop culture cues from, given that on Necromunda, for example, it's even known as Soylent Viridian. So within Hive cities, yes, you may have a Mercantile Paladus or a Corpse Guild, an undesirable task, but an essential one when you consider the fact that many hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of human citizens are born and die on a weekly basis. The logistical problem of collecting and processing of those who perish is quite obviously terrifying. Without a Corpse Guild, the nightmare of body disposal would lead to the disaster of widespread disease and contamination even more than usual. Life for a member of the Corpse Guild is far more a desirable role, no matter its importance. They'll collect daily thousands of corpses within their designated sectors and transport them to be piled high within mortuary caverns, which are then steadily rendered down in grinding machines aptly named corpse grinders. The superstitious nature and high mortality of Imperial citizens means that those within the Corpse Guild are also regarded fearfully by many, who will lock up their meagre dwellings, leaving the dead neatly stacked outside for collection. And while the dead are processed to ensure the survival of the living, recycled meat is also noted as being vital to the survival of many hive worlds. So-called corpse prospectors will target sources for the corpse grinders, seeking out veins of meat down in the underhive. And like so many denizens of the underhive, they adorn themselves with decoration of individuals who live lives which wallow in the slaughter of others. These corpse harvesting parties will adorn themselves with horrifying masks, inscribed rebreathers, and a whole tool belt of ancient surgical tools to quickly check on the value of their secured meat materiel, to determine if it's worth disposing of or hauling back for processing. Bone scriveners may be seen scouring through the aftermath of gang battles, raking over the dead for their raw material worth. The corpse guilds and grinders exist out of a necessity more than desire for their horrific activities. However, their very existence now likely attracts those who desire the sanctioned activity of such horrors. The nobility might still prefer to refer to them as recyclers. Then we also have water guilds. And you might think, well, they're in charge of managing the vast labyrinthine network of water processing within a hive city. Is that so bad? Well, yes, they are, but they hold this power over others, like a proverbial sword of Damocles. Water is their wealth, and none should wish to cross the Water Guild and have their sector cut off from the water supplies, because water must be acquired by the guild by any means necessary, refined and traded. So-called Nautican delegations seek out water within hive cities or the worlds that they're built upon, and often this will mean travelling deep into the underhive. Master Nauticans are not merely engineers, they're skilled fighters, just truly any who exist within a hive world, and they're accompanied by Siphonites, who carry specialised tools known as exsanguination staves. These will bleed the very water from the bodies of victims as they speak litanies to the God Emperor over and over. This leaves their victims as little more than shriveled, dried-out husks of humans behind them. The Nautican lead these patrols to harvest water, and while this may seem a wild drop in the ocean, if we consider an individual, it's worth remembering that water upon a hive world is recycled over and over many times, so what might seem a very small amount, the fact that they are continually reclaiming water, this once harvested, becomes over time a considerable wealth of aqua for the Water Guild to be reprocessed and contribute overall again and again. But then there are more speculative roles, and one that often people have voiced is that of bone processing. It's true that the Imperium really do enjoy their bones and their skulls. This is not something that is heavily documented about, though, in a very specific way. It's one of those aspects of the lore that's sprinkled throughout vast reams. And suffice to say, though, there are varying shades of bone processing. So please note also that some of this is my own speculative thoughts and not referenced. There are, of course, as we just discussed, the corpse guilds, and while it's not specifically noted, I think it would go without saying that they'd likely do a roaring trade when it comes to skulls. Although most of the time, we get the impression that bodies for the corpse guilds are just loaded onto conveyors, dropped into massive grinders, and this is where we might consider the bone scriveners. And they don't necessarily, though, have any real specific role when it comes to bones, despite their name. They just pick through the dead and assess them for processing. So maybe, though, somewhere in there, they're selecting people with certain skulls. Why? Who knows? When it comes to, say, Imperial Astartes, though, and the bones and relics you see them often adorned with, I think it's safe to say that no scum from a hive city is going to be touching the bones of a dead Astartes, or likely any processing of the bones of one of the Emperor's angels is going to be done behind closed doors, within their chapter monastery, likely with endless chanting and worship from the ecclesiarchy, chaplains and watchful brother marines. I can only imagine that processing of the bones of fellow Astartes is done so by Astartes, because the thought of any other touching something so important seems unbelievable. Maybe chapter serfs, and so on. And then when it comes to servo skulls can vary in their origin. They might be vat-grown skulls, artificially produced, but often servo skulls are the skulls of important mentor figures, officers, very venerated veterans. In some cases, maybe somebody's nemesis within an Imperial organization such as the bureaucracy. The grim joke, of course, is them floating around, continuing to serve their life's quarry is not going to be lost on those who survived them. But again, the key thing here is that within the Imperium, the skulls and the bones that we see, they're not seen as disgusting or bleak or macabre. It's seen as to serve the Emperor beyond death. And this is a great honor. To be made into a servo skull is to continue in service. So this is not actually seen as a negative or horrifying thing for the Imperium. Nonetheless, they really do love their skulls, and we might imagine that there are in fact vast processing plants which solely operate on the production of human materials, boiling of bones, sucking out of organic material into huge vats to be reprocessed by the corpse guilds. This is one of the truly nightmare aspects of Imperial life, the ordinary, matter-of-fact way in which the human individual is used as little more than the building blocks for the Emperor's vast galactic empire. Lastly, we come to what is really a fairly straightforward but nightmarish role for any serving human citizen of the Imperium. Life aboard a black ship, and quite honestly, this could mean anyone aboard a black ship, including the Sisters of Silence, for these vessels are miserable, bleak, horrifying places which only contain misery and human suffering. These so-called black ships belong to the Adeptus Astra Telepathica, They do in fact operate entirely independent of the Imperial Navy, and are surprisingly the second largest fleet in the galaxy. The reason for this is, of course, it's necessary to bring in enough Psykers to continually feed the Emperor's insatiable hunger for the souls of the Psykers day after day. There are many thousands of black ships, but only the highest ranking adepts in the Adeptus Astra Telepathica know the true scale of the fleet and the vast scope of its operations. The black ships are tasked with collecting any and all unauthorized, that is to say, rogue Psykers. Their background is irrelevant, their age and any other considerations irrelevant. All must be collected by the Sisters of Silence. And the Sisters, who once held a proud position as the Emperor's closest serving guardians, second only really to the Custodes, and who played an indelible role in the forging of the Imperium, who in M41 likely do still operate in matters of critical importance, working alongside the Custodes, the Astartes, and Inquisitor. As nulls, blanks, pariahs, they have long been of high importance to the Imperium, to Malkador, the Emperor, but they're also tasked with now one of the very worst, most depressing, harrowing tasks imaginable, rounding up rogue humans, often only children, and dragging them back to Terra for whatever fate awaits them. The black ships are a torturous environment. Security measures are in place, designed specifically to confuse and confound psychic abilities. Each ship has its specially trained adepts whose sole function is to focus their own psychic energies into an occluding sphere. This metaphysical device broadcasts an invasive signal into the mind of any nearby Psyker, severely disrupting their abilities. Additionally, what amounts to extremely loud white noise is played through the containment areas of the ship to disrupt the minds of the Psykers held there. On top of all of this, the lighting within the holds of the ships is dim, just above darkness, but it will be punctuated with bursts of strobing bright light to continually blind and disorientate those within. Any food or drink given to the Psykers will mostly contain tranquilizers or sedatives, and the population of Psykers will be regularly rotated from one hold to another. All of this serves to keep the Psykers in a helpless, confused, and compliant state, but many will of course become entirely broken by the time they reach Terra. Although this does not make them any less valuable for their ultimate purpose, the most dangerous Psykers, as identified by inquisitorial scrutiny, are kept in isolation cells deep within the bowels of containment holds within the ship. In order to operate the black ships effectively, of course there must be a crew. And while the crew of a ship will spend most of their time in specifically designed psychically shielded upper decks, far from the containment holds patrolled by the Sisters of Silence and other null wardens, none can exist in total ignorance as to what they are doing. The crew will, for one, have been specifically recruited to this task, and I don't care how shielded an upper deck is, they must have some semblance of what is taking place. Considering how tortured the Psykers are, there must be sometimes bleeds of psychic power, mental bonds that take place. Maybe the upper crew have endless nightmares. Then, of course, there's the navigator and the astropathic complement for a ship. These, who are even more carefully attuned, must suffer some from the continual tortured Psykers below and the continual presence of the Sisters. All around, the black ships are just truly a complex tempest of mental suffering and psychic activity, and just visually must be one of the most hellish environments that exists within the Imperium. Despite the souls below said to be held in varying degrees of confinement, witnessing the misery for the Sisters of Silence themselves must torture them mentally. Sisters have, for example, made note of how troubling the apparatus of the Golden Throne is, and questioning even the sacrifice of innocent humans. But now here they are, doing this in an unending process of essentially murder, across many thousands of ships all across the galaxy. It must affect them in some way, and it must truly be a miserable job, rounding up screaming children, dragging them away to this torture ship. The Sisters of Silence are not made of stone. They've not been scoured of all human emotion. And so this must really be one of the worst jobs imaginable. So let's talk about my next selection for Audible. For me, the Warhammer Crime series has been a total breath of fresh air, although in the vast cities of the Imperium, obviously not literally. Varan Gantua is a vast hive city on the Imperial world of Alecto. Specifics about the hive are elusive, but we do know that the population is in the standard billions for hive cities. We also know that it's so geographically large that it actually stretches across different climactic zones. And because of this vast size, Varan Gantua has been subdivided into numerous districts, which are watched over by a class of enforcers backed by various other security roles, even down to local observers and patrolmen. The 40K crime series is focused on this city of Varan Gantua, because when it comes to the Imperium, one hive city is enough to tell a lifetime of stories. Importantly, this series, as noted, is focused far more on the civilian activities of the 40K verse, and it means we're allowed a rare glimpse into the darker underbelly of Imperial life, along with the bizarrity of just ordinary human life in the Imperium. And these are the kind of stories I really love, because they add flesh to the bones of humanity in M41 and help us understand the perspective of ordinary civilians and just existence in a hive. Like, for example, how most upon this world do not truly believe that the so-called Xenos really exist. They've never seen them or anything about them. So to the people who live there, these are just stories from out in the void. Fishman's tales. No one really believes that these things are true. How could they be true? It's an amazing level of insight to just how much of a disconnect there is between life at the human level here inside of a hive and life at the vast transhuman highest levels of Imperial bureaucracy. They're almost two incomparable things. In the Vorbis conspiracy, one of the districts has been heavily damaged by some unknown cataclysmic event, and the security forces and enforcers have to investigate. The mystery and the stories of those tasked with uncovering the truth become intertwined with those of petty criminals and desperate citizens, even drawing in the unwanted attention of agents beyond Alecto itself, potentially risking the world's place in the wider Imperium. But again, one of the things that I enjoy that you see through this is the ordinary stories. One of the probators, for example, yes, he's carrying out his role, he's doing his investigation, but really what he's thinking about is, can I just upgrade my hab cell of a room that I live in to a slightly larger one? And that's his biggest driving force, not the greater good of the Imperium. Flesh and Steel couldn't be more different. We follow one of the investigators of the security forces as they explore deep into the darkened hell of servitor, production, and the Mechanicus in one of the rare examples describing this initial chilling process of servitor conversion. He's teamed with a tech priest who together must uncover some of the most bleak examples of reality for citizens living in the Imperium of M41. I've so far wildly enjoyed all the Warhammer crime series, and sadly not yet have all been converted to audiobooks, but there are many which have, and for the characters and setting, the stories are suitably dark and offer an often much needed break from the Astartes-heavy ongoing series like The Heresy. The Vorbis Conspiracy, Flesh and Steel, check them out. As a final reminder, if you're new to all this, you can start listening today, and new members always get that free 30-day Audible trial. As a member, you'll get full access to thousands of audiobooks, originals, and podcasts included in the Plus catalogue. Visit audible.com/Lutin or text Lutin to 500-500 for those in the US. Thanks as always to all for your support, and I'll see you all in the next one.